question.
I'll be fascinated to see where this segue takes us. The fourth was what had made me suggest bowling. After the meteor, I found fire raining from the sky considerably less appealing. I turned back to the lane where the pin boy had cleared the last of the pins and was safely perched on his high stool. He had a comic out, and even from here I could recognize Superman's distinctive red and blue costume. But back to bowling. To knock down both pins, I'd have to strike one at just the right angle to cause it to fly across and hit the other. I could see the trajectory. Give me a piece of paper and I could describe it for you with mathematical precision. I swung the ball back, its weight tugging on my arm like additional G-force, then brought the pendulum forward, aiming at the pin on the right. The ball released and for a brief instant arced weightless through the air before thudding against the smooth poplar floor. It rumbled down the lane and I stood there, arm outstretched, as if I could will it to hit the pins correctly. It brushed the pin on the right, which wobbled, and then tipped to land spinning on the floor. The other pin stayed perfectly upright. A commiserating groan rose from our little group. Laughing, I turned back and curtsied. Next time. Nathaniel patted me on the shoulder as he took his place on the lane. Myrtle laughed. Next time. I keep waiting for them to throw us out this time. My bowling isn't that bad. Eugene and Myrtle exchanged a look like I had just said something adorable, and then belatedly my brain caught up with my mouth. The us, Myrtle meant, wasn't our bowling party, but Eugene and her. Before the meteor, they wouldn't have been allowed in at all. This place would have been filled with white people, and I wouldn't have noticed. Now, with Kansas City being the capital, Myrtle and Eugene weren't the only brown people in here. They were still outnumbered, but at least no one was glaring at us. Embarrassed that I hadn't noticed the imbalance until she pointed it out, I marked my score down on the sheet and dropped onto the bench next to Eugene. He handed me my beer and raised an eyebrow.
So what's this I hear about an air show?
I don't know if it's going to happen. The beer was cold and had a bright acidity. The idea was to prove that women pilots have the ability to be astronauts.
But?
Nathaniel's bowling ball careened down the lane and slammed into the pins, throwing them clear in a beautiful strike. Yes! I lifted my beer to my husband's success. But we only have leisure craft. The more I think about it, the more I realize that no matter how good the show is, it won't look as flashy as a show with military planes.
That's a pity. Pilots would know it was a feat, but the general public looks at the trappings.
Eugene shook his head as he stood for his turn. He clapped Nathaniel on the back.
Good job, York.
Nathaniel picked up his beer and leaned against the back of the bench.
The air show?
Yeah. Myrtle peered over her glasses at him.
You make your wife follow through on that. It's a fine idea.
Nathaniel held up his hands and laughed.
You have a very different idea of our marriage than I do. I don't make Elma do anything.
The pins cracked and bounced, but Eugene had left one standing.
I don't know why she thinks any husband can make his wife do anything. Never worked with us.
You hush. Myrtle threw a wadded-up napkin at his back. Laughing, Eugene waited for the pin boy to clear the pins and roll his ball back to him.
So you need Mustangs.
Wouldn't that be nice? I sighed and took a deep sip of my beer. I hadn't flown a Mustang since the war, but they had been by far my favorite of the planes we had to ferry. Swift, agile, and a beautifully responsive machine. It might not be the highest tech these days, but it had been glorious back then. Eugene's next bowl knocked that pesky pin down. He let out a hoot and pumped his fist.
Now who's cooking with gas?
Myrtle rolled her eyes and stood.
He loses his train of thought so easily.
Giving her a peck on the cheek as they traded places, Eugene grinned.
Do not.
He leaned down to pick up his beer.
How does six Mustangs sound?
I stopped with my beer in midair. Six? Six Mustangs. Where? Eugene grinned.
My air club has six of them.
My jaw literally dropped. Are you serious? I've called all the... No. Wait. I pinched my nose. Someday, I swear to God, I will learn this. I called all the white air clubs.
Ha! Huh, take that!
Myrtle jumped in the air. All of her pins had scattered in a strike. She spun around.
And none of you saw that, did you?
I shrugged. Six Mustangs. Myrtle exchanged a look with Nathaniel and shook her head slowly.
Pilots.
He sighed and raised his beer to her.
I don't know how you do it.
I let them have their laugh and just grinned at Eugene. 6 Mustangs. We could do proper formations with that and smoke tricks and... Are there any women pilots in your group?
Yeah. Come to the club and I'll introduce you.
He gave me a wink.
We can go for a spin and leave these two on the ground.
14.
IAC launches manned spaceport made of an inflatable fabric. By Bill Becker. Special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas. April 21st, 1956. The world's first space station is a huge spinning wheel of 4 sausage-shaped links.
The Kansas City Negro Aeronautics Club had a nicer facility than our women's club did. There was a little house next to the hangar, both of which had been painted blinding white with red shutters and lettering. As soon as we walked into the social room of the house, I became self-conscious and grateful for Eugene's presence as a shield. I was the only white person in the room. The brown faces ranged from magnolia tan to a deep blue-black, with no one who was even as light as Myrtle. I stood out like a dirty handkerchief dropped on a clean table. Clutching my purse tighter, I planted myself in the door to keep from backing out. Everyone was staring at me. I tried to smile, and then I realized that the way I was hanging onto my purse, they probably thought I was worried someone was going to steal it. I let go, and that probably looked just as bad. Eugene turned back, smiling, and beckoned at me to follow him to a table with 3 black ladies sitting at it. Conversation started up again in the social room, but I kept hearing snatches of, "What's she doing here?" and "White," and "No business." Some of them, I think, weren't trying to keep their voices down. 2 of the women stood as we came up to the table. The 3rd stayed seated and stared at me with a neutral expression, with only a pinching of the nose to indicate disdain.
"This is Miss Ida Peaks."
Eugene gestured to the younger of the 2 standing women. She was short, with generous curves and ruddy brown cheeks. The other standing woman wore her hair in an elegant French twist, pinned with green Bakelite combs.
"Miss Imogene Braggs and..."
He gestured to the seated woman. Her orange dress with a narrow white collar gave her a warmth that her expression countered.
"Miss Sarah Coleman, some of the finest pilots you'll ever meet."
"Thank you for meeting with me." I took off my gloves and, at Miss Bragg's gesture, sat down. "I believe Major Lindholm has explained our aims to you?" Miss Coleman nodded.
"You want to be an astronaut?"
Well, yes. But my main goal is to get the IAC to consider women as pilots. The current group is entirely composed of men." I turned to smile at the 2 friendlier women. "I was hoping that you would consider flying with us." Miss Peaks tilted her head to consider me.
"So you can use our planes?"
Something about this conversation was off. I glanced at Eugene, but he had stepped back. That is a separate discussion, I think. "And if we turn you down about using the Mustangs, would you still want black women to fly with you?" Miss Bragg's tone was gentle, with mild curiosity, but the words held a challenge. "It depends upon the reasons for turning us down, I suppose." That answer caused Miss Coleman to sniff. "If it was because you doubted me as a pilot, then that doesn't seem like it would be a good collaboration, but otherwise, yes, I should still like you to fly with us. Major Lindholm has spoken very highly of your performance in the shows your air club has put on, and I need experienced pilots."
"Good. I'm game, then."
Miss Peaks grinned at me.
"Any chance to do some more formation flying is fine by me. You are okay with formation, right?"
"Absolutely. I was definitely planning that." It would take a liquid ton of rehearsal, but precision flying was mission critical if we were going to convince people that women pilots were as good as men. Miss Coleman shook her head.
"There's no point in it."
"Sarah."
"No, don't hush me. You know good and well that even though we're qualified, even if this air show scheme were to work, we wouldn't be allowed in the astronaut corps."
She glared up at Eugene.
"Would we, Major?"
He cleared his throat.
"Well, no. They only took 7 men and had to take those from different countries and...
And none of those countries selected anything but a white man."
"The makeup of the list bothers me as well. That's why we're trying to change things with the air show. Once they see how qualified you are..." Miss Coleman leaned across the table, face intense.
"I was accepted into the WASPs during the Second War, until they realized I was black. And then they asked me to withdraw my application. What makes you think that the IAC is going to be any different?
Well, because we're talking about a colony and I remembered what had happened in the days after the meteor hit, when the people in the black neighborhoods were left for dead until Eugene and Myrtle had used their leaflets. And we'll make them. But to do that, we have to show them we can fly first.
Miss Peaks shrugged. I already said I'm in. Y'all can keep arguing, but nothing's going to change if we just sit here.
Slowly, Miss Braggs nodded.
If nothing else, it'll be fun.
Miss Coleman stood. I've got better things to do with my time than help yet another white lady exploit us.
Exploit?
I stood too. Now see here, I'm inviting you to fly, not to mop floors or serve dinner. She smirked. See?
That's the only way she can picture us. I'm a mathematician and a chemist, working in pharmacy, but all you could think of were servant roles for me. So, no, thank you, ma'am. You can just go on and convince yourself that you're trying to save us. It'll be without me.
She strode off, leaving me gaping and with my skin too hot. I'd probably gone bright red with anger and embarrassment. I should have known better. I'd made the same mistake with Myrtle when we first moved in, and I assumed she was just a housewife. She'd been a computer for a black business that had manufactured hair straightening chemicals.
I hadn't even known such things existed.
I'm a fool. Would you please convey my apologies? She's absolutely right. I gathered up my purse and started to pull my gloves back on. Thank you for your time.
Did you say there was formation flying?
Miss Peaks stared after Miss Coleman. I stopped with one glove half on. Yes. I didn't say, if we can get the planes, but I thought it.
And when's the first practice?
Does this mean you're still willing to fly with us?
She turned her gaze back to me, and a corner of her mouth curved up.
I already said yes.
Then she winked.
Besides, that went better than I thought it would.
I laughed, relief making it too loud. I can't see how. She cocked her head, and her smile didn't change, but the meaning of it did.
You apologized.
Have you ever gotten exactly what you wanted and then realized that it had unintended consequences? That was me and the air show. In addition to Nicole Wargan, we also had commitments from Ann Spencer Lindbergh.
Yes, that Ann Lindbergh.
Sabiha Gökçen, a Turkish fighter pilot in the Second World War, and Princess Shakovskaya, who had fought in the First World War before having to flee Russia. I hoped the fact that she was an actual fighter pilot and a princess would draw some attention. Betty had been ecstatic because the princess was a publicity goldmine, and Nicole, bless her, had worked her political contacts and come up with a list of guests that staggered the mind, or at least my mind. Vice President Eglin's wife, Charlie Chaplin, Eleanor Roosevelt, which is how I came to be sitting in a borrowed Mustang on an airfield surrounded by bleachers and camera crews. More than one crew. All I have to say is, thank God for princesses, even aging ones who no longer had a country. It turns out that given a choice between interviewing a physicist housewife and a princess who flies with a tiara, they opted for the tiara. I was fine with that. I was even happier when it was my turn to fly. Nicole, Betty, and I were set to do some formation flying with Miss Peaks and Miss Braggs of the Kansas City Negro Aeronautics Club. They'd supplied us with the Mustangs, and as Eugene had promised, they were damn good pilots. And they'd convinced Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to attend. Have I mentioned that the crowd was immense? We queued for takeoff, following Miss Peaks with military discipline. The first part of the routine was simply a tight V formation, buzzing the airfield. I say simple, but during our second pass over the field, we rolled into a vertical bank of 180 degrees while keeping the V tight and even. After years of puddling around in my Cessna, flying at speed in a Mustang with a group of amazing pilots, a part of me came back to life, a part that might have withered and died even before the meteor struck. The seat pressed against my spine with the G-force of our turns, and the little blips of turbulence from the planes around me gave a tangible sense of the other pilots. These women made me feel vibrantly alive. The people in the stands below, they might as well have been asleep for all they mattered in that moment. We roared past them, banked to climb into a steep arc and then split apart. This next bit was Senator Wargan's idea. It was cheesy as all hell, and I couldn't wait. Six planes, seemingly flying out of formation and yet perfectly in sync.
Over the radio, Miss Peake said,
On my mark, ladies.
It was a formality when she said,
Mark.
A moment later, though, because we were all already where we should be. I hit the button to release a stream of colored smoke in time with the others. We each dipped in an individual arc, passing the other planes in an intricate choreography designed to avoid the wake of turbulence from each other's slipstreams. Behind us, in red smoke against a silver sky, we wrote the word Mars. I finished the final upstroke of the M and glanced over my shoulder. The ground lay at my back, past the red mist. My angle was all wrong to read it, but from here it was enough to see that our individual strokes all connected. Damn, we were good. I turned forward again and hit a bird. Then three more smacked into me. Feathers and blood flashed past the plane with meaty thuds. I had to tilt my head to the side and scrunch down to see past the carnage on my windscreen, but by God, I managed to stay in alignment with my teammates. My position is probably why I didn't see my coolant levels drop, or the engine temperature rise, or the thick, dark smoke pouring out of the back of my plane to mix with the red. I thought I had escaped the bird strike unharmed until my propellers sputtered and failed. A bird must have been sucked into the radiator and cut a coolant line. Not that it mattered in that moment what had caused it. I had no engine. My plane was pointed straight up. No engine, no lift from the wings. The ground rolled overhead as the first turn of the incipient spin. There was a moment of zero-G as the plane stalled out, and everything seemed to float. Then the spin started in earnest. The urge to pull back on the stick was so strong, but that would have killed me. The plane flipped over again, showing sky, and then earth, and then nothing but the fairground spinning like a toy below me. Red and black smoke whipped past my windshield, blending with the blood of birds. G-forces pressed me against the right side of the plane and squeezed the breath out of my chest. Right side spin. I kept my hands lightly on the stick and pushed the throttle all the way forward. My vision started to go dark from the outside, from the G-forces, as I fought to stop the roll. Stick, hard left, full opposite the spin. The muscles in my arm burned, trying to fight the pull, and I just braced myself harder, pushing. God damn it. I knew how to get out of a spin. I just had to get control again. My altitude ticked away. The rudder fought me every inch, but I got it to the left. With that, the spin slowed, but I was still aimed at the ground in a dive. My canopy was smeared with blood and feathers. All I had were instruments. According to the instruments, I still had enough height to pull the canopy and bail out, but by God, I wasn't going to crash a barred plane while I still had space to maneuver. Dragging in a breath against the G-forces, I yanked back on the stick to pull the plane out of her dive. The tunnel vision got worse as I pulled at least 3 Gs, but it was that or ditch the plane. I was not going to do that. I tightened my legs and abdominal muscles, trying to force blood back to my brain as the G-force increased. Blacking out was not an option. I kept my eyes on the instrument panel, relying on it to tell me when I was finally back to straight and level. My vision started to clear, and I took a full, deep breath before looking for the runway. I still had to land, but that was the easy part, even with obscured vision. The Mustang was a darn good glider, and I had enough height to bank and come around to the runway. I passed over it once to get a sense of range and then pulled a 360 to make another approach so I could come in to land and to try to kill some speed. My flaps were useless from the bird damage, so it was going to be a really fast approach. I peered right and left using the spots of clear windshield to gauge my position relative to the ground. It rose up to meet me and I slapped the wheels down, bouncing harder than I liked from the speed. Breaking the plane, I brought her to a rolling halt at the end of the runway. I'd need someone to tow her to the side until we could look at the engine. Birds. God, I hated birds. Well, when flying, I hated them. Although, to be fair, the bloody birds had come out of this a lot worse than I did. A giggle came on me out of nowhere. Bloody birds. I was a terrible person. But I was alive. Sliding back the canopy, I hauled myself up as the remaining pilots flashed past overhead back in formation. They'd given me clearance to get under control, but should be heading into land now. I was clear of the runway, wasn't I? I turned to look over my shoulder. The runway was clogged with people. Cameramen and reporters and audience members and everyone was running toward my plane. Everyone. I waved from the cockpit so they'd see I was okay. I didn't need help. They didn't need to come running out here. Not all of them. The flight helmet was pinching around my throat. I could barely draw breath. Fumbling with the strap, I couldn't get my fingers to unbuckle the thing. My gloves, too bulky. Couldn't even get them off.
Mrs. York! Mrs. York, are you all right? What happened up there? Was that part of the show? Or did you lose control of the plane? Over here, Mrs. York! Over here!
Who was talking? There were so many people. If I hadn't still been in the cockpit, they would have crushed me in their midst. All of them crowded around the plane, and I couldn't tell where the voices were coming from. Just a mass of people shouting my name over and over again. A man climbed up onto the wing, talking into a microphone.
I'm standing on the wing of a Mustang flown by Mrs. Nathaniel York, who just survived a near-fatal mid-air accident. Mrs. York, can you tell us what happened?
On the other side of the plane, a man with a camera had set it on a tripod on the ground. Another man stood in front of him, gesturing back at me. They hadn't even let me get out of the cockpit. I ripped at my gloves, trying to yank them off my hands. Let me down, please.
Poor thing, she's shaking.
Around us, more people called my name. The man on the wing shoved the microphone at me.
Can you tell us how you feel?
I turned and scrambled over the opposite side of the cockpit, hopped down and slid off the wing. Like an idiot, I landed next to the television reporter.
Oh, and here she is now, Mrs. York. It must be quite a fright to have something like that happen. You're lucky to be alive.
Lucky? He thought I was frightened because of the tailspin. They all thought I was shaking because of it. I pressed my hand against the wing and tried to steady myself. I lived because of training that I received as one of the women Air Force service pilots during the war.
Of course, but it still must be frightening.
Not really. The birds in the air startled me, of course, but surprises like that are why we were put through such rigorous training as wasps. I gestured to the air where the other women in our group were still circling. If I could only turn the attention away from me as easily as they circled. Any of the other women in our group could have overcome that spin the same way I did. In fact, we have it easier than men in those circumstances because our bodies are not subject to the same degree of strain from the G-forces in a spin.
And how did it feel to be in that spiral of death?
Well, the death spiral is a different type of spin. I tried to do the society smile that Nicole used to such good effect. But when you're in the middle of a tailspin, if you've been trained, you only think about what to do next. I save the panicking for when I'm talking to reporters. That got a chuckle from the crowd. I kept my hand pressed against the warm wing of my plane. It had kept me alive, even after those damn birds. One good thing about the Moon and Mars missions, those pilots won't have to worry about hitting birds. Another laugh. I do hope that people will enjoy the rest of the air show, and think about what our lady pilots can do for the space missions. If we want colonies, we'll need women in space.
That's interesting that you say that. Can you tell me why?
Oh, dear. I'm not sure if I should explain where babies come from on television. Through the crowd, I saw Nathaniel. Or I didn't even really see him, because he was still fighting his way through. I felt him, his terror and the way he drove through the crowd to try to reach me. And now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go reassure my husband. The crowd laughed even louder. I didn't intend that last bit of double entendre when I said it, and I was fairly certain that no amount of reassurance would calm Nathaniel down any time soon. Wading into the crowd, I kept my head down, concentrating on the hard tarmac. Men's shoes, ladies in heels, gray cuffs, stockings with crooked back seams, and hands. Hands touching my shoulder or arm or back as people said my name.
Mrs. York.
And then finally,
Elma.
Nathaniel's arms went around me in a shield. I wanted to cower into them, but I used his strength to draw myself up. People were watching, and I could not disappear. People were watching. That thought did not help. I could barely breathe. But my husband was here. I lifted my head to seek his eyes as a guide wire. Their crystal blue was covered by a sheen of tears, and their edges were rimmed with red. His hand shook where it pressed against my back. I put a hand against his cheek. I'm fine. Love, I'm fine. It was just a tailspin.
30% of aviation fatalities are from tailspins.
He clutched me close and pressed his cheek against mine.
God damn it. Don't just a tailspin me.
I don't know where the laughter came from. Because I wasn't dead? Because panic and hysteria are two sides of the same coin? Because he loved me so much he just resorted to statistics to express it? Well, now you'll have to revise the numbers, won't you? Because I didn't die. He laughed at that and picked me off the ground. The crowd stepped back as he swung me in his arms. That's the image they showed in the National Times. First, there's my plane, tumbling out of control, and beside it, a photo of me, laughing in the arms of my husband with a crowd of people standing around us. Those are the only photos of me because, as soon as we got off the airfield, I locked myself in the bathroom. Every time I thought I was together enough to go back out, I could hear the voices of reporters in the hall and got queasy all over again. So I waited until the air show was over and my stomach was empty, and Nathaniel's worry when he knocked on the door was too much to ignore. It would make more sense to be afraid of the crash, but I was afraid of the reporters, and I was ashamed to be so weak. 15.
Lady Pilots Thrill Airshow Throng by Elizabeth Rawls, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, May 27th, 1956. Hundreds of aviation enthusiasts turned out at the municipal airport here yesterday to watch the first international show of women pilots. Of particular interest to the throng was Princess Shakhovskaya, formerly of Russia, who flew loops in her vintage biplane.
The smells of garlic and ginger wafting around Helen's kitchen had my mouth watering. I was on cocktail duty and was mixing another batch of martinis for the lot of us. Women pilots perched on every available seat, leaned in doorways or, in Betty's case, sat on the counter. Betty held a newspaper clipping in one hand and the remnants of a martini in the other.
I quote, "The lady pilots acquitted themselves with admirable skill and thrilled the attending crowd. The pilots performed many astonishing feats, not least of which was the military precision of their formation flying, led by Miss Ida Peaks of Kansas City."
Ida sat at the table in the corner next to Imogene. Opposite them, Pearl, who had found a babysitter for her triplets, kept blinking around the group as if she were startled to be out of the house after dark. We'd even managed to get Sabiha Gökçen to join us before she headed back to Turkey, although the princess had declined our kind invitation with regrets.
The most breathtaking moment of the air show came as Mrs. Nathaniel York.
Why they not use your name?
Helen glared at the large pot of vegetables she was stirring as if it were the newspaper.
It's standard convention.
I poured a measure of vermouth into the pitcher of gin. And I like being married to Nathaniel.
Just wait until Dennis asks you to marry him.
Betty waved the newspaper at him. And you're Mrs. Dennis Chien.
Wait, what?
I turned from the martinis.
You have a beau?
Helen stared at me, holding the spoon in one hand and shaping the word with her mouth.
B-E-A-U. It's French for boyfriend,
supplied Pearl.
And why don't we know about him?
Helen rolled her eyes and looked back to the pot of vegetables.
Just because he's Chinese doesn't mean we're dating.
I blinked.
Wait, Dennis Chien from engineering? He's a lamb. We're not dating.
She spun and pointed the dripping spoon at Betty.
You, read article.
Aye, aye, ma'am.
Betty took a healthy sip of her martini and lifted the paper again.
The most breathtaking moment of the air show came as Mrs. Nathaniel York hit a flock of wild geese and lost power to her engine.
I winced and glanced over to Imogene. I'm still so sorry about that.
Yes, and I'm sure you controlled the flight pattern of geese.
She shook her head. And you paid for it, so hush. Helen snorted.
Good luck getting her to not feel guilty on something.
Raising my hand, I said, Jewish. It was also why I'd insisted that Nathaniel and I cover the damages, even though it wiped out our savings, because I didn't want anyone to think we were being cheap.
And Southern. It's encoded in my DNA. Try being Catholic.
Helen said from the stove.
Agreed.
Pearl nodded.
I'm feeling guilty just sitting here.
The point?
Betty cut in and waved the newspaper clipping over her head.
Is that my article got picked up by the AP? Which means it went out to all the major papers and millions of people read it. So, we need to start talking about our next move.
Sabiha Gökçen raised her hand.
Another airshow?
Is popular, yes?
Maybe we could do one in another city, Ida said, like Chicago or Atlanta.
Nodding, I added ice to the martini pitcher. Or Seattle. Nathaniel's been talking with Boeing about their KC-135 refueler, and no, we can't fly her, but still. Even getting Boeing to loan us one of the first production models to be a static display on the field would draw a lot of attention. There are probably local pilots there that might be good to pull in. Betty shook her head.
The decision makers are here in the capital. We need to do something here. Like getting an air show televised, live.
I nearly dropped the ice tray. Facing all of those reporters had been bad enough when it wasn't live, but being broadcast to the nation? No, thank you.
Ooh, Pearl clapped her hands together. What about the Dinah Shore show? She has guests on sometimes.
And she's Jewish.
Betty leaned across the counter toward me.
What about it, Mrs. Nathaniel York? Want me to see if I can get you on there?
Pretty sure I'd have to sing to do that. I left alone the assumption that all Jews must know each other and stirred the martinis, focusing on the chilling picture as if my life depended on it. Condensation began to form on the outside as the gin cooled. I think just flying in an air show will be enough for me. What about Ida?
This better not be an assumption that because I'm black, I can sing.
That article lists you as the leader of the formation segment.
Has Dinah Shore ever had a black guest?
I pulled the spoon out of the pitcher. A more immediate question is, who wants another martini? Everyone did. Me? I wanted a double. Back at work, the goal of reaching the moon carried on. I had been working on a series of calculations for orbital rendezvous. In theory, the astronauts would be able to ask the computers on Earth to do their calculations, but there would be times when they would be out of radio range, so we needed a way for the astronauts to work it out on their own. If the IBM was smaller or more reliable, that might be an option, but even that would require them to do preliminary calculations. A shadow fell across my desk. Mrs. Rogers, who ran the computing department, stood there with a frown. Her steel-gray hair was pulled back in a bun that made her look more severe than she really was.
Elma, you have a call in my office.
A call at work? I ran through the list of people who would call me at work and came up with exactly two. Nathaniel, who was just down the hall, and Herschel. My heart dropped into my stomach. Swallowing, I pushed back my chair. Thank you, Mrs. Rogers. Masira looked up at me from across our shared desk.
Everything okay?
I shrugged to hide my concern. Let you know in a minute. Was hurricane season about to get really bad? Had one of the kids been injured? Was it his wife? Or God, what if Doris was calling because something had happened to Herschel? Polio could reoccur. What if he'd fallen and hurt himself? Wiping my mouth, I followed Mrs. Rogers to her office. She gestured me inside where the phone lay off its hook on the desk. She stopped at the door.
I'll give you some privacy, but try not to take too long, hmm?
Of course. I went in and only belatedly remembered to say, thank you. Taking a breath, I wiped my palms on my skirt before I picked up the phone. Elma York here. A masculine voice, someone I didn't know, answered.
Sorry to bother you at work. This is Don Herbert.
Don Herbert. The name was vaguely familiar, but I couldn't place it. In the absence of any other clues, I fell back on my mother's training. How do you do? He chuckled, which I prayed meant it wasn't something terrible.
Well, thank you. And yourself?
Fine, thank you. I fiddled with the phone cord and waited.
I don't expect you to remember me, but we met during the war a couple of times. You ferried a couple of bomber planes to me when I was with the 767th Bomb Squadron in Italy.
Oh, Captain Herbert! Yes, yes, I do remember you. What he hadn't mentioned in the "we met" statement was that he'd called down some fighter pilots who were making catcalls at me and my co-pilot. Whatever this was, it wasn't about my brother, so I let myself sit down. What can I do for you?
Well, funny thing. I had a bit of a career change after the war, and I saw the newspaper article about you and that spin you pulled out of and the whole thing about astronauts, and have you heard of the show Watch, Mr. Wizard?
I
That was not at all where I thought this conversation was going. For a moment, I thought he was going to invite me to be an astronaut, even though I knew that invitation would have to come from Director Clemens. Yes, yes, I have. My niece is very fond of it, although I have to admit I've not seen it myself.
That's all right.
It's just that we don't have a television. He laughed.
It's all right, really. It's just me doing the kind of science that you're so far beyond it would bore you to tears.
Wait, you're Mr. Wizard?
Told you I had a career change.
His laugh hadn't changed, and I suddenly wished that I had watched the show so I knew what he looked like now.
The thing is, my producer's daughter saw the clip on television of you pulling out of that spin and declared that she wanted to be a pilot like you.
That's very flattering.
So, we got to talking, and I was wondering if you'd like to be on the show.
I hung up the phone and pushed back from the desk so fast I nearly knocked the chair over. Sweat coated my back and prickled under my arms. Was this a rational response? No, it wasn't. But be on television? Be on live national television? No, no. That was impossible. All of those people staring at me? And what would happen if I made a mistake, which I would? What would people think? The phone rang and I jumped like a test launch had misfired. I think I squeaked. My hand pressed against my chest and beneath my palm, the beat of my heart pounded in double time. The phone rang again. I could be rational. I wasn't, but I could act like it. Wetting my lips, I picked up the phone. Mrs. Rogers' desk, Elma York speaking.
Don Herbert here. Sorry about that. I think we got disconnected.
Yes, I was wondering what happened. Liar. I covered my eyes and leaned forward to rest my elbows on the desk. You were saying?
That we'd like to have you on the show. I thought we could talk about the physics of flight, maybe do a simple experiment about lift. The format is real simple.
I wish I could, but we're so busy preparing for the next launch. I just don't know if I could get the time off.
We can work around your schedule.
That's very kind, but maybe I could suggest another woman pilot? Betty would be brilliant at this.
Sure, it's just that, well, my producer's girl is kinda keen that it be you. I don't need an answer right away, but think about it, eh?
Sure, sure. I'll think about it. I would think of a way to say no is what I would do. The next couple of weeks were genuinely busy at work, which seemed to be a constant. So I hadn't needed to lie much when Don called back a week later just to see if I had any questions. I'd pretended to be too busy to talk, the launch, the fate of humanity and all that. But he gave me his number so I could call back. I hadn't. But life outside the IAC continued on. After work, Myrtle and I hopped off the streetcar outside the Amish market. It was midway between our apartments, and I liked the owners better than at the grocery closer to where Nathaniel and I lived.
How long you think you'll stay at work?
Myrtle jumped over a puddle to reach the sidewalk. Long enough for me to bake cookies and then go back for him? On the sidewalk near the bus stop, a homeless man sat with his knees drawn up in front of him. A little girl leaned against him, clutching a scrap of blanket. I steered over to them and dropped a dollar in his cup. Some might see it as extravagant for a tzedakah, but Nathaniel and I could have been them. Myrtle trailed after me, and I heard the rattle of coins hitting the cup before she caught up.
So we have enough time for talking?
I pushed open the door to the market. Not you too.
What?
Her eyes were wide and innocent.
Just thinking we can have a girls' night. Eugene's on rotation out at Edwards Air Force Base, so I'm at loose ends.
Mm-hmm. I picked up a shopping basket and nodded to Mr. Yoder, who ran the Amish market. Even with his broad straw hat, his simple dark suit always put me in mind of the Hasidic Jews back home in D.C., entire family lines of which had been wiped out by the meteor. I dug in my purse to check my ration book. Darn it, I'm out of stamps for meat.
You should go on Mr. Wizard.
She picked up a bunch of radishes and put them in her basket. My heart started racing just at the name of the show. It had been a mistake to tell the women in the computer department, but I thought they'd laugh. I hadn't expected them to encourage me to go. In hindsight, that was stupid. You're bringing it up just like that, no lead-in or sliding up to the subject? The lettuce looked good, but we had some growing in the window box at the apartment. I hadn't considered the orientation of the fire escape to the sun when we rented the place, but we'd gotten lucky. So long as one of us remembered to water the boxes, that is.
Tried that. Girls' night, remember? So?
She weighed a bunch of grapes in her hand, but put it back, tisking at the price. I don't know. How could I explain that I panicked? In a way that made sense to her, or to anyone, really. Even me. Are those tomatoes? Nestled among the greens was a box of pale, greenish orbs with only the barest blush of pink. It hadn't been warm enough for tomatoes in ages. Sure, you could get greenhouse tomatoes from farther south, but they were almost always mealy and tasteless by the time they reached Kansas City. Behind me, Mr. Yoder said,
"We had some ripe ones earlier today, but they went fast."
"That's fine." I picked up three of them and grinned at Myrtle. "Come over, I'll treat you to fried green tomatoes, and you can make martinis and try to convince me to go on Mr. Wizard." 16.
Punjab faces food shortages. Special to the National Times. Karachi, Pakistan, June 26, 1956. Mian Mumtaz Daltana, Chief Minister of Punjab, Pakistan's granary, has told the Legislative Assembly that Punjab will face an acute food shortage next year if the meteor winter continues.
I hate vomiting, and this was the second time today. The taste of the morning's coffee still clung to the back of my throat. God damn it. I was going to have to fix my makeup again after those nice women had taken such pains to make me presentable for the television cameras. What really angers me when my body portrays me like this, and I try to focus on the anger, is that I haven't always been terrified of crowds. But I can't shake the memory of being in college and all those young men staring at me, and the mockery, the teasing, the hate. I could solve problems in my head that they couldn't even do on paper, and the teachers, damn them, kept shoving that in their faces until I just wanted to quit and hide. But I was also my father's daughter. He believed in me so thoroughly that I couldn't shame him by not trying. And I still want my father to be proud of me, even though he and Mama have been gone for 4 years. Let's just say that I've learned how to vomit discreetly, and I still hate it. Someone knocked on my dressing room door.
Mrs. York!
I gripped the edge of the toilet as my stomach cramped again. Swallowing, I snatched a piece of toilet paper. Just a minute! It took only a minute to blot my face and reapply a thick red layer of lipstick. As I walked to the door, I pinched my cheeks back into brightness. My hands were still shaking, but if I kept them by my side, it shouldn't be too obvious. I had tried smoking in college, so they'd have something to do, but it just made the shaking worse, and it tasted like a rocket fueled by a pigsty. Sorry to keep you waiting. My voice might have even sounded normal, if you didn't know me. As it was, all breathy and low, I sounded more like Marilyn Monroe than myself. The waiting assistant smiled over his clipboard.
Not a problem, Mrs. York.
But he led me down the hall at a brisk clip toward the studio. My stomach cramped again. 3.14159265358979323384. At least Watch Mr. Wizard was a children's show, so there wouldn't be that many people watching. Only 91 stations. That was just 2 million viewers. Or more. How could new studios have such poor air circulation? 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, 23, 29, 31, 37, 41. The soundstage was brilliantly lit. They'd given me a quick tour earlier, and the assistant now led me onto the fake back porch of Mr. Wizard's house. 43, 47, 53, 59, 61, 67, 71. This would just be a conversation with a man I knew from the war. If I didn't think of him as Mr. Wizard, if I could remember him as Captain Don Herbert, I'd be okay. I just had to talk to him. Only him. Beyond the door, someone said,
We're live in 5, 4, 3.
Live broadcast is go. Confirmed live broadcast. I pressed my hand against my stomach and breathed through my mouth. Don was a good man, and there wasn't a live audience. It would just be him and the child actor. God damn it, why had I said yes? The assistant, he'd had a name, I should know his name, held his clipboard and nodded to the stage. That was my cue. Beyond the wall, Don was talking, waiting for me to walk through the door. I just had to open the door. The knob was right there. Get it together, Elma. If your father could see you standing here trembling in the dark. The assistant solved my problem by knocking on the door. On the other side of the fake wall, Don said,
Come in.
And then my mother's voice sounded in my head. Shoulders back, head up. You're a young lady, not a camel. Shoulders back, head up. I opened the door and walked onto the stage. Don was standing by a kitchen counter with his shirt sleeves rolled up. A young girl, no more than 10, stood at the counter with him, in a cherry red skirt and snug pink cardigan. Her glossy brown hair had been smoothed back from her face in ways that wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes when I was a child. Don had a model airplane in his hands as I entered.
Well, look who's here.
He set the plane down on the counter and turned to the little girl.
Rita, this is my friend Elma York.
How do you do, Mrs. York?
He held up a finger.
Actually, you should call her Dr. York. She's a doctor, but not a medical one.
Gee, really?
My eyes stung a little. He hadn't told me he was going to do that.
I suppose that's right.
I have doctorates in physics and mathematics from Stanford, but most people just call me Mrs. York.
Well, you're Dr. York today, because I need your help with some physics.
He picked up the plane again.
I was just trying to explain aerodynamics to Rita here.
I'd be happy to help with that. As I walked to the mark they had chalked on the floor for me, Mr. Wizard leaned down to Rita again.
You see, Dr. York is also a pilot.
Rita smiled like a consummate child actress.
Keen? She's the perfect person to help me understand how airplanes fly.
And rockets, too.
Mr. Wizard grinned.
But more on that later. For now, let's look at the wing of an airplane.
Nathaniel had my overnight bag in one hand as we walked up the stairs to our apartment. He swung it to the side when we passed the bottle blonde from 3B. She was tottering down the stairs in heels and bright red lipstick, which suggested a night out. She smiled at me.
Saw you on television last night.
Oh, I gripped the banister and smiled vaguely at her. Did you say thank you for that?
I didn't know you were so smart.
Her front teeth were stained with smoke, though God knew how she could afford both tobacco and rent. Thank you? Nathaniel took a step back down toward me.
I'd better get her home. She just got back from Chicago.
Chicago! That must have been something.
I edged past her. I hardly saw it at all. I went to the television studio and then straight home. Turning on the stairs to watch me, she clasped her hands together and just beamed.
To think, I know someone who's been on television.
Know me? We lived on the same hallway, but I had no idea what her name was. We just saw each other on the stairs sometimes. I can hardly believe it myself.
What was it like?
She took a step up to follow me. Nathaniel put a hand on my arm and sort of drew me to him.
Now, I'm sure you ladies could talk all night, but I haven't seen my wife in 2 days. We'll talk to you later?
Oh, sure.
She giggled.
That would be swell. Good night.
With a good night of our own, we escaped onto our floor. Nathaniel glanced over his shoulder and rolled his eyes at our neighbor.
Was I right that you needed an escape?
God, yes. I kept my voice low because sound could echo down the stairwell. Do you know her name? He shook his head.
I was hoping you did. We'll check her mailbox tomorrow. Tonight, though, I've missed you very much.
Likewise. I leaned over to peck his cheek as he fumbled with the keys. How shall I make up for being gone? He turned the key in the lock and pushed the door open.
I was thinking more of ways to convince you to stay home.
It was just 2 nights. Can't you? The phone rang.
Mother.
Nathaniel flicked the wall switch. It clicked. The room stayed dark.
Sorry, must have burned out.
The phone jangled on the other side of the room. Don't worry about it. I made my way across the apartment, which really wasn't that dark with the light from the hall and the city outside. A beam of orange sodium vapor light fell across the phone as it rang again. York residence. Elma York speaking.
Is this the famous Dr. Elma York?
My brother's laugh conjured his face in the dark. The corners of his eyes always crinkled when he smiled. Oh, stop. No one calls me that.
Except Mr. Wizard. Elma, you were great.
Beaming, I wrapped the phone cord around my hand and sat on the sofa. A compliment. You must be getting soft in your old age.
Well, I'd better get with the program. Look at you. I thought the newspaper clippings you sent were keen, but television? And Doris tells me you were in... What was that?
His wife said something in the background.
Women's Day. Mama and Pops would have been so proud of you.
I wiped my eyes with the back of one hand. Well, I almost threw up all over the set.
Couldn't tell.
There was a little hesitation there, as if he wanted to ask something, but he just said,
You're great, really great, and your fan club starts here. Speaking of, there's a fan who wants to talk to you.
The phone rustled as he passed it to someone. Nathaniel was fumbling in the junk drawer, still in the dark. I stretched over to reach for the table lamp on the other side of the couch.
Hello, Aunt Elma.
The sweet, breathy sound of my niece's voice filled the receiver.
Rachel, how's my favorite niece?
I pulled on the lamp's chain, but it stayed dark. Like an idiot, I tried again. Hang on, darling. Nathaniel, I think it's the fuse.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the flashlight.
Oh, sorry. It's at the airfield. The Shabbat candles are in the bottom drawer. I returned to the phone. Sorry, Rachel. I had to help Uncle Nathaniel find something.
Was Mr. Wizard nice?
He was very nice, sweetie. Did you watch the show?
I always watch Mr. Wizard, even before you were on, but I like you better than him.
I laughed, tucking my feet up under me on the couch. In the front of the apartment, Nathaniel lit a candle and brought light to our tiny studio. I gave him a thumbs up and he grinned. Well, you know me.
That's not it. I thought I wanted to be a scientist like him, but I want to be an astronaut like you.
I'm not an astronaut. I racked my brain, trying to remember what I'd said on the show. I'm just a pilot.
But you want to be an astronaut, and you're a doctor, and Daddy says that you're really smart and you can be anything you want to be and you'll be an astronaut someday, so I want to be one too.
Pressing my hand over my mouth did nothing to stop me from crying. Your daddy says a lot of things. Wanting something isn't enough by itself.
I know that.
Ah, the scorn of a 9-year-old.
You have to work hard, too. What do I need to do to be an astronaut?
Things you won't necessarily like. Like eating your vegetables so you can be nice and strong. And doing all your math homework.
Now you sound like Daddy.
I laughed. You were the one who said you wanted to be an astronaut.
Well, I do.
And I do, too. The little girl on the show had also said she wanted to be an astronaut, which I thought was part of the script, but she'd said it again when we went off the air. I was too limp with relief to really reply, but I wished I had now. So you need to make a list of all the things you need to learn and then start working, all right? Someday, you and I are going to be on Mars together.
Really?
Her voice grew muffled and fabric rubbed against the phone.
Aunt Elma says we're going to Mars together.
I could hear Herschel laughing in the background, and then his voice was in my ear again.
Now I'm going to have to buy her model airplane parts.
I'll mail her a kit for her birthday.
That'd be swell. Oh, say, have you gotten the invitation for Tommy's bar mitzvah?
I stood, grabbing the phone by its base. Hang on, let me check. This was one of the benefits of our tiny apartment. Not only did I have less to clean, but I could drag the phone across the room to the kitchen table and the cord would reach. I was out of town the past 2 days. That was a good excuse. But the truth of the matter was that once we started working on the air show, I'd been ignoring the mail. And since then, well, I hadn't anticipated any of this attention. Nathaniel was unscrewing a fuse from the box, but when he saw me, he lit another candle. I took it from him, cradling the phone between my head and shoulder. There was a stack of mail on the table, and I flipped through looking for the envelope. By candlelight, it was almost romantic. Maybe when I got off the phone with Herschel, I'd suggest to Nathaniel that fixing the fuse could wait. When is the bar mitzvah?
December 15th. Doris says to tell you we've got the guest room all set for you.
That's wonderful. One of the envelopes was yellow. On the outside, in bright red ink, a stamp read, "Overdue."
Herschel, may I call you back? Tell Tommy that we'll be there. I wouldn't miss it.
As we said our goodbyes and hung up, I wasn't really listening. I'd torn open the envelope and had slid out the overdue bill inside. My stomach twisted as if I were about to address a crowd of thousands, but this time it was only an audience of one. I'd been so busy with the air show and interviews and television that I'd gotten behind on the bills.
I forgot to pay the electric bill.
The silence remained after my words vanished. Candlelight flickered on the table, and I finally saw the rose standing in a vase on the table. At current prices, it was as if he'd bought me a dozen.
Nathaniel, I'm so, so sorry.
He left the fuse box hanging open.
Hey, you've had a lot on your mind. It's all right.
The stack of mail on the table all but glared at me. I had barely been cleaning the apartment, and now this. I'll go through the accounts tomorrow. Make sure I didn't miss any others.
It's all right.
He blew out his candle and walked around the table to me.
I'm just happy to have you home.
Then he blew out my candle. I think he meant it to be romantic, but it left us standing in a darkness of my making. 17.
Insulating Concern heats house for $12 a month and a 2-year test. Kansas City, Kansas, July 14th, 1956. In cooperation with the UN's Climate Committee, the Owens Corning Fiberglass Corporation undertook a 2-year test program involving 150 new houses in all climatic regions of the United States, Europe, and parts of Africa. The test homes were comfort engineered and required trees and trellises for shade, a wide roof overhang or heat-repellent screening, and attic ventilation.
Before we got home from the synagogue, I needed to take my coat off. It felt like it must be in the mid-70s. On the one hand, thank God it was finally warming up. On the other, I knew what the warming meant. We were hitting the beginning of the greenhouse effect. I stood, my coat over my arm, as Nathaniel crouched to open our mailbox. He tipped his hat back on his head.
Huh, I wonder what this is.
Inside the box, a large padded envelope nearly filled the entire space. He wrestled it free, and the thing seemed to expand as it came out of the box. The last edge came loose suddenly, and Nathaniel lost his balance and fell back on his rump.
You okay?
I bent to retrieve a couple of other envelopes that had dropped on the floor.
Fine, fine.
He reseated his hat and clambered to his feet, staring at the envelope.
It's for you.
I stopped in the process of slipping the other envelopes into my purse. Me?
From NBC.
He tucked it under one arm and bent down to shut our mailbox.
Betcha someone got fan mail.
Don't be silly. It's probably just a thank you gift or some such thing. We started up the stairs, but my heart was pounding before we even reached the first landing. I wanted to believe that no one had watched the show. And yet, when we got to the apartment and settled in, the giant envelope, taking up most of the kitchen table, I circled around it as if it were a cobra or something equally deadly. Nathaniel sat down at the table and pulled out the rocket booster design he'd been working on when I'd talked him into leaving the office yesterday.
That looks suspiciously like work.
I opened the refrigerator and rummaged through it, trying to figure out what we'd have for lunch.
And you look like you're about to start cooking.
He looked up at me and winked.
You knew I was a terrible Jew when you married me.
I just made a comment.
Mm-hmm. And you don't get to use Shabbat as a weapon if you're going to ignore it, too.
Fine.
I shut the refrigerator door. For me, the observation was as much about discipline and reminding myself of who I was as anything else. It had seemed important after the Holocaust, and then again after the meteor, because Grandma would have... Grief pops up at the strangest times.
I'll cook after sundown, which isn't until 9 tonight.
if you'll take an actual day off.
Wait. Let me see if I understand this. You're trying to convince me to not work by offering to not feed me.
Nathaniel tapped his pencil against his chin.
There's something not quite right here.
Oh, I'll feed you. Cold cuts and guilt. I laughed and pulled the envelope toward me. Best to get it over with. Sitting down opposite him, I patted the giant envelope proprietarily. Besides, I have to see what's in this. He laughed and stood, giving me a kiss on the back of my neck.
I'll make sandwiches, and if I'm right and it's fan mail, then...
Then what?
You'll have to think of some way to reward me for being right.
Righteousness should be a reward in itself. I pulled the envelope open, and more envelopes fell out. Damn.
Ha!
Nathaniel opened the refrigerator and said again,
ha!
Sandwiches, husband. Some of the envelopes had beautiful penmanship. Others had been addressed in actual crayon. Bemused, I picked up one of the crayon-addressed envelopes and laughed aloud. This is addressed to the lady astronaut. Well, more accurately, it's the laddie astronaut.
That will be my new pet name for you.
Nathaniel set a cup of iced tea on the table next to me.
Chicken on rye, okay?
A little onion too, please? I opened the laddie astronaut letter and pulled out a sheet of grubby primer paper. Oh, my heart is going to break. Listen to this. Dear laddie astronaut, I want to go into space too. Do you have a rocket ship? I want a rocket ship for Christmas. Your Fred, Sally Hardesty. And there's a picture of a rocket.
Just wait until you actually get into space.
Dishes rattled behind me as he worked on the sandwiches.
We'll have to get a bigger mailbox.
If. And that's a big if with a lot of other ifs before it. I put Sally's letter back in the envelope and set it aside. I wouldn't be able to answer her until after Shabbat was over, but I could triage the letters. I didn't know if I was going to be able to answer all of them, but at least Sally Hardesty and the other crayon writers.
I have faith.
I thought you were a bad Jew.
I have faith in you. Speaking of which, I could use your help on an orbital parameter question.
He pulled a loaf out of the bread box and set it on the counter. Use a cutting board.
I was going to.
Releasing the knife he'd grabbed, Nathaniel bent to retrieve the cutting board from under the sink.
I think we can skip the translunar orbit and go straight to a lunar orbit, which would save a lot of time and materials.
And risk the astronauts' lives through inadequate testing? I pulled another letter toward me and ran my finger under the flap to open it. Dear Dr. York, I didn't know that girls were allowed to be doctors.
I'm not saying we'd skip the Earth orbit, just the translunar one. We're sending an unmanned mission around the moon to get pictures in September, so we'll know that orbit can be done. Having someone orbit the moon, though...
I would like to be a doctor. A lunar orbit involves transferring in and out of orbit, which is a whole different set of orbital mechanics. You have to change from the sphere of Earth's influence to the moon's and...
I know. I'm not asking about the mechanics of it. You already worked out fuel consumption and a flight plan. What I'm asking is if there's any compelling reason to do the translunar orbit as a manned mission.
Seems like something you should be asking Parker. I slapped the letter down on the table, not even sure why I was irritated with Nathaniel.
Well, he's not a physicist, is he?
Ah, that was it. We'd been here before, where he asked me for advice because he wanted to prove Parker wrong about something. It reminded me too much of my college days and being used as a tool to keep young men in line in math class. Nathaniel only knew about that in the most general sense, mostly as stories that I managed to make sound funny. I took a slow breath and folded the letter carefully. Pressing down on the fold with my thumbnail, I creased the paper with a fair bit of vigor. Sorry. I just... Okay. The primary reason to do the translunar orbit first is so that if we're wrong about fuel consumption for the transit, it gives the crew a larger margin of error for getting home. And they only get one shot.
But the math.
Sweetie. I'm a physicist, but I'm also a pilot. If you're asking me to tell you that skipping steps is okay, I'm not going to do it. They get one shot at getting home. If the math is off, even a little, and they don't have the fuel to correct, Then they go shooting past the Earth or burn up on re-entry. I shove the letter into the envelope. And I also don't want to work on Shabbat.
You're answering fan mail. Doesn't that involve writing?
His voice was consciously lighthearted, and I loved him for making the effort. I'm reading, not writing. He set a sandwich next to me, the bread sliced in a diagonal. Leaning down, he kissed the top of my head.
You're right, and I'm sorry.
I shouldn't have gotten cranky.
Well, let's eat lunch, and then...
He walked to the shelf and pulled down a book.
And then I'll read.
Narrowing my eyes, I stacked the letters on the side of the table until after lunch. I see the word Mars on that. He laughed and showed me the cover.
It's a novel. Clemens lent it to me. Says it's a comedy, at least in terms of spaceflight. Does that count as taking the day off?
Yes. I beamed up at him. Yes. And thank you. We had been sitting in the dark room with nothing to do for the last 2 hours and 23 minutes, and yes, we were all counting, as we waited for them to resolve an issue so the countdown clock could continue. It wasn't even anything wrong with the rocket itself, just an automatic cutoff that tripped when it shouldn't have at T-minus 30 seconds and holding. It had to be worse for the three men strapped into the giant Jupiter V rocket outside. At the capsule communicator station, Stetson Parker tossed a tennis ball into the air, his headset pushed back behind one ear. Every couple of minutes, he grinned and said something into his comm. As Capcom, he was in charge of filtering all the information from the scores of engineers and computers down to the stream that the astronauts needed in their capsule. Was he talking to Jean-Paul Lebourgeois, Randy B. Cleary, or Halim Hot Dog Malouf? For the first time, none of the astronauts going up were Americans. And to my eternal surprise, Parker had turned out to be a polyglot. French, Arabic, and of all things, Gaelic. Helen leaned across our shared table. Hey, you going to the 99th this weekend? I shook my head and straightened the pencils on my side of the table. I'll be wiped out after this. She tisked and turned back to the chess game that she was playing with Reynard Carmouche. That tsk had been a masterful use of a single noise to convey disappointment and resignation. I lifted my head and stared at her dimly lit profile. What? Last week you said you were trying to stay rested for the launch. She moved a pawn a space forward and Carmouche cursed in French. I was. The graph paper stuck to my fingers as I picked it up to tap it straight on the edge of the table. And you've got your solo license, so it's not like you need me in order to fly anymore. At this, Carmouche looked up.
You can fly?
Yes. Helen pointed at the board.
Are you going to play or just stare? I am thinking,
he protested, crouching closer to the board as if putting his nose between the pieces would solve the puzzle for him. Helen turned back to me and leaned across the table. The desk light focused down on our papers, leaving an unearthly, uplit glow on her face.
Why don't you come to the 99th anymore?
There are a lot of new members. Our core group still came, and Ida and Imogene had joined us. But after Mr. Wizard and the articles about me, we'd gotten a sudden influx of members. There were only so many times I could handle being asked for an autograph or to pose with someone. I shrugged and straightened my pencils again. I miss the small group. Helen nodded, tapping her fingers on the desk.
Give it time. They lose interest if you aren't there. The ones that are just tourists, I mean.
The tension sighed out of me. Thank God for friends who understood my fears without me having to spell them out. Especially not here in the dark room where I wanted to be as professional as possible. Carmouche finally moved a knight. Helen turned back to the game and immediately moved a bishop.
Check.
Stetson Parker's voice cut through the room from the Capcom desk.
What's the word on the delay? Prayer time is coming up from Malouf. He cannot get out of his chair to pray.
Clemens jabbed a cigar toward Parker.
He's not asking to. He just wants to avoid being mid-prayer if the countdown starts again.
When the countdown starts, we shall let him know.
Clemens turned away from Parker and barked,
York! Status!
Nathaniel looked up from the console he was leaning over. He had a telephone pressed to one ear and was jotting down something, his nose wrinkled in concentration. He held up one hand to silence Clemens. God, I loved my husband. Parker snorted.
I'll tell him to go ahead and pray. Might speed things up.
He pulled the mic back into place and murmured to the astronauts. I glanced at the big clock on the wall. If this went another hour, we'd lose our launch window and have to wait until tomorrow. It wouldn't be the first time we'd scrubbed a flight, but it was never pleasant. Checkmate. Helen leaned back in her chair and crossed her arms. Checkmate is go. The Frenchman's jaw